You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The Atlantic published an article this Monday that detailed exchanges between Donald Trump Jr. and WikiLeaks during the 2016 election campaign. The American intelligence community believes that WikiLeaks was chosen by the Russian government to disseminate emails from the Clinton campaign that they had hacked, and that Donald Trump Jr.'s cooperation had been actively sought. Joining us now is journalist and author Luke Harding, whose latest book is Collusion, Secret Meetings, Dirty Money, and How Russia Helped Donald Trump Win. It's published by Vintage, and I'm very pleased it has brought him back to our show. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And you wrote this book before the direct messages or DMs between Donald Jr. and WikiLeaks were released. Were you at all surprised by that story?
No, I've actually done a previous book on Julian Assange, and I know him pretty well. I worked with him in 2010 on leaked US State Department cables, and let's just say that Julian has a fairly loose relationship with the truth. So when he says no collusion, nothing to do with Russia, nothing to do with the Trump campaign, I always took that with a pinch of salt.
When you were writing that book, did you have any sense of links between WikiLeaks and Russian intelligence?
Well, yes. I mean, first of all, there's the US intelligence assessment, which said unequivocally in January of this year that essentially WikiLeaks was a kind of cutout, and that these were Kremlin hackers who were busting into Democratic Party servers, taking stuff and giving it to WikiLeaks and to Julian for reasons of plausible deniability. So it was the kind of perfect route.
But Assange claimed when WikiLeaks began that WikiLeaks was about radical transparency and bringing down powerful people. If they are working in the service of the Russian government, when did they abandon their original mission?
Well, I mean, I kind of work pretty kind of closely with WikiLeaks, and like all partners, we sort of fell out. Every so often, Julian sends vicious tweets about me in the early hours to his 4 million followers saying I'm a horrible human being and stuff worse than that. And I think the problem is, without getting too much into kind of psychology, is that Julian views the world in kind of Manichean terms. And the countries that support him, like Russia and leftist nations in Latin America, and countries that he hates and sees as an enemy, especially the United States, Hillary Clinton when she was Secretary of State. And so that's how he kind of divides. And of course, the Russians have taken advantage of this, and I think have been instrumentalizing WikiLeaks for some years now.
You've said that we're living in a golden age for nonfiction. Was it odd writing this book while the story was happening?
Well, I mean, Leonard, that's a kind of interesting question. I don't think it was odd. I mean, bear in mind that
Did you feel pressure? I'm sure that as you were finishing up a chapter and you opened up the newspaper or somebody called you with a lead, you thought, oh, am I ever going to be able to finish this book?
Yeah, I think it's a thrilling story. And my book is actually, it's about Russia and Trump primarily. It's about the kind of Russian side of this story. We know a lot about the American protagonists, about Paul Manafort and Michael Flynn and others. But we know less about the kind of Russian side. And I spent 4 years in Moscow as The Guardian's bureau chief, and I was kicked out in 2011. And I sort of fell into the mincer, as it were, when I was living in Moscow and had personal experiences of being harassed by the FSB, which is Putin's old spy agency. So I kind of brought that to the table. Additionally, I met Christopher Steele in London before his dossier was published. And I sort of thought, yeah, for sure, events will kind of overtake the story. But I still think it's probably the most important story of our age, and I was very keen to tell it.
And the FSB was, as you say, harassed you for the 4 years you were there. Why? And you also describe some of the harassment as that they have a kind of a sexual fascination.
Well, I kind of wrote articles, I think, that the Kremlin considered to be taboo and off limits. And bear in mind, I arrived there in 2007. That was the time when basically Russian state media by this stage was under Putin's thumb. And the foreign media, me, the New York Times, others, we were increasingly kind of dissonant. We were doing stuff the Kremlin didn't like. And so I wrote stories about Putin's money. He's officially got $100,000 a year. Unofficially, probably he's the richest guy in the world. And everyone in the Russian elite understands that. And I wrote stories about the murder in 2006 of Alexander Litvinenko, who was a London-based dissident, famously poisoned with a radioactive cup of tea.
And that was another book.
That was another book. That was my last book, A Very Expensive Poison. So there was no subtlety about how they told me they didn't like me. There were break-ins at our family apartment. stupid clues left behind. I talked to the British Embassy, who said, look, regrettably, your flat is bugged. They've got video as well. Proof of this came one day when we came back from holiday to discover a strange book by the side of the marital bed next to the kind of middle-class novels that I'm sure your listeners read and enjoy. This was a Russian sex manual, and the KGB, the FSB, had bookmarked it to a page on orgasms. And basically they were saying, you know, we're watching, and maybe you're doing something wrong, you know, technical issue or frequency issue or whatever. And the reason I tell you this is, I mean, it was darkly, grimly funny, and I still have this book on my bookshelf. We show it off at kind of dinner parties. But if you think about the deeply contested events of 2013, when Donald Trump flew to Moscow for the Miss Universe beauty pageant, you know, we can't say definitively how he behaved in the Ritz-Carlton suite, but what we can say with absolute certainty is that the FSB would have videoed everything, including his bedroom. I mean, if they bothered doing it with me, a troublesome foreign correspondent, they would do it with any guest staying in the presidential suite. So there will be a tape. The question is, what's on the tape?
You go back to when he went to Russia the first time, when it was still the Soviet Union, when he went with Ivana. Why was that an important visit?
I think it's crucial. I think one of the things I tried to do in this book is to sort of show that what happened in the incredible events of the 2006 American election didn't fall from the sky. What the Kremlin did was part of a long tradition of subversion and covert influence stretching back to Cold War times. And typically the KGB would try and recruit people. They would try and identify targets that might be useful, not because they would necessarily become presidents of the United States, but people that they could kind of develop. And I think what's not really understood about Donald Trump's first visit to Moscow in the summer of 1987 was he was invited by the Soviet government. I found that the daughters of the diplomat who invited him, and they basically confirmed there was a very concerted attempt to woo Trump and to bring him over. And not only that, but the people who organized his visit was the Soviet travel agency called InTourist. InTourist is basically the KGB. It's not me saying that. I've talked to defectors who say that. And so Trump was brought to Moscow by the KGB. Now, does that mean he's a KGB agent? No, it doesn't. But does it mean that there was an interest in him from both the Soviet regime and its Russian successor? Yes, it does.
I'm speaking with Luke Harding, whose latest book is Collusion, Secret Meetings, Dirty Money, and How Russia Helped Donald Trump Win. Hasn't there been some disagreement about how the word collusion might be applied to these stories? Because collusion isn't a legal term.
Well, in a way, I'm not a kind of advocate or a jurist. I'm a storyteller. But I do think in terms of kind of the definition of collusion, I think we're well across that line now. And the number of secret meetings we know, including, as you mentioned earlier, the exchanges between WikiLeaks and Donald Trump Jr., but also the famous meeting in the summer of 2016 when a Kremlin lawyer bearing gifts meets Paul Manafort, meets Trump Jr., meets Jared Kushner. And the more that comes out, the more we realize that there's a pattern of interaction between Russians, some of them suspected intelligence agents, and people from the Trump team.
And we'll get to some of those meetings, but I'm interested in what just happened after he met Vladimir Putin at the APEC summit in Da Nang. President Trump said just this past Saturday that he believed Putin when he denies that he had anything to do with meddling in the 2016 election. Also dismissed the assessment of U.S. intelligence chiefs that the Kremlin was responsible for a politically motivated hit job that damaged his ability to work with foreign leaders on matters of life and death. Now, why do you think that President Trump continues to favor Putin's denials over his intelligence agencies, although he did later backtrack a bit on that?
Well, Leonard, I mean, that's the huge question. I start my book with that, is how do you explain the fact that Donald Trump, let's face it, is so rude about everybody practically on the planet, apart from nice Mr. Putin, who he's flattering about and has yet to criticize. And he likes Duterte too. But it's basically, it's a kind of conundrum. It's a riddle. And if you believe the Steele dossier, which broadly I do, that this dossier by Christopher Steele, the former MI6 spy, Putin has some kind of hold or leverage over Trump. I mean, that's certainly how it looks to me. But the other thing to bear in mind about Putin is that he lies all the time. I mean, what he says has got zero truth value. And Putin doesn't, I mean, for him, it's an operational tactic. They teach you this stuff in KGB spy school. And you lie, not necessarily to convince, but to wrong foot, to cause confusion and so on. And the fact that the president accepts the word of a former KGB agent over the very sober staff assessments he gets from his own intelligence community is astonishing.
Now, does Putin have special qualities that allow for the confusion? For example, when George W. Bush said that he looked into Putin's eyes and he saw his soul, Colin Powell, the former Secretary of State, said he looked into Putin's eyes and he saw KGB.
Well, I'm more of the Powell school, if I'm honest. I mean, the thing is, Putin's been in power for a long time now, 17 years. He's effectively a sort of soft dictator because Russian elections aren't real elections.
And even when he was out of power, he was in power.
Even when he was out of power as prime minister, he was running the show. And his worldview is essentially Soviet. It's that there's a sort of phrase that Russians understand called Chekist, the first sort of Bolshevik secret police were called the Cheka. People from that kind of security espionage background believe in conspiracy. They're deeply paranoid. They see America as what's known in Russian as the glavny protivnik, the main adversary. That was true in Cold War times. It's true now. And what Putin is doing, both in the US election and more generally in Europe, is classic KGB doctrine. He's trying to influence, he's trying to nudge events, politics, in other countries, in Russia's favor. And he's kind of succeeded big time, actually. I mean, the U.S., I would say respectfully, is consumed by Trump and by its own divisions. And this leaves Russia free to do more or less what it wants on the international stage.
You point out in the book that it's important to remember that Russian hackers also stole emails and other information from the Republican National Committee, but never published them.
Not yet. But the great joy about being in Putin's position is that he can turn the dial up or turn it down, depending on what happens. And let's say Trump starts criticizing Putin or starts doing hostile things, then you can imagine there'll be kind of countermeasures, let alone the whole question of this dossier. And for sure, that there will be a very big dossier on Donald Trump. There'll be material dating back to the Soviet era. There'll be stuff from Czechoslovakian spy agencies from the 1970s when Trump first managed Ivana. There will be a personality assessment. There'll be intercept material. These people are very professional.
Didn't the release of the DNC emails coincide with the airing of the Access Hollywood tape? Could that have been just a coincidence?
Well, yeah. I mean, Republicans
well, one
say
wiped
it's got
out
nothing
the other.
To do with it. But I mean, I think the more we know about the engagement between Trump Jr. and WikiLeaks, it doesn't look like a coincidence to me. And we also, I mean, I know from my own sources that Julian absolutely loathed Hillary, but more to the point, thought that she would win.
We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll talk about your meeting with Christopher Steele and with Paul Manafort and others. My guest is Luke Harding of The Guardian. His latest book is called Collusion, Secret Meetings, Dirty Money, and How Russia Helped Donald Trump Win. It is published in this country by Vintage. I imagine it's published in England by a different company.
It's being published worldwide tomorrow and in a whole number
So we're
of
the first people to talk to you about this.
You are.
Well, I'm so pleased that you've come on our show. We'll talk more about it right after this. We're back with Luke Harding of The Guardian. His latest book is Collusion, Secret Meetings, Dirty Money, and How Russia Helped Donald Trump Win. It's published by Vintage. And you begin the book with a meeting with Christopher Steele, the former MI5 spy who started...
MI6.
Oh, it's six.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah, yeah.
Well, I'm off by one. He started a firm called Orbis Business Intelligence Limited. What does Orbis do for its clients?
Well, Orbis now very famous, but essentially it does the same kind of stuff he did when he was working in British intelligence. It does investigations, it files reports, and it's based on secret sources.
And the dossier that he's been associated with hadn't been made public at that point?
No, I mean, the curious thing was that when I met him, it was December 2016, and we'd heard rumors, of course, of its existence. I hadn't seen it at that stage, but Steele himself was very tight-lipped about it. He didn't say a huge amount. But, of course, when it came out 4 weeks later when BuzzFeed published it, and initially the report was it was a sort of ex-British spy, we immediately thought it's Steele, and of course it was.
Now, it has been challenged as a fabrication. What do you think?
Well, the people who say it's a fabrication, it seems to me that they repeat it as if that would make it so. And of course, that doesn't make it so. And I've talked extensively to Steele's friends about this and put the same question. And his response, as they tell me, is that actually the dossier is between 70 and 90% accurate. It's broadly correct. It's a piece of raw intelligence, which doesn't mean that it's flawless. But essentially, I think he thinks that it's right, and that he'll be vindicated by events and is being vindicated the more we discover.
He wasn't allowed into Russia, so he's relying on sources?
Yeah, but what you have to bear in mind is firstly, he was a junior spy there in the 1990s when the Soviet Union collapsed. So he's been basically working on this country for 30 years. But also what you have to understand is that he did a whole series of reports. This is a sort of new aspect of my book on the war in Ukraine from 2014 to 2016, which were very well received in the US and the State Department, were fed up to John Kerry and Victoria Nuland and were seen as being correct all about Putin's covert military invasion of Ukraine and annexation of Crimea. Now, what I understand is that those sources who were right on Ukraine were the same sources with a track record, a credible track record, who reported to him on the Trump dossier. And actually, Steele didn't know, when he sent this query out in early 2016, he didn't know what the answer was. He said, what are the links between Donald Trump and Russia? And essentially, the messages he got back from his sources were apocalyptic. I mean, he told a friend that this was, discovering this stuff was a quote-unquote life-changing event, and that the whole subject was a radioactive hot potato. So he didn't come in with an agenda or with a political objective. He just asked the question, and the reports he got were hair-raising.
And got a lot of attention from late-night comedians, but that's a whole other matter. What brought you to Steele? Wasn't it a lead that Trump's campaign had been secretly funded by the Russians?
Well, we were investigating several tips. One of them was financial. It was about the role played by Western banks in possibly funding the Trump campaign and Trump personally. So we were, basically, these are stories that we were actively pursuing that we were bouncing off him to sort of see.
And you'd also had a lead that that high-ranking Russian bureaucrats and well-connected insiders had laundered $20 billion, and that involved a network of British lawyers, Moldovan judges, a Latvian bank, limited companies that were registered in London. Well, where had that lead come from?
I mean, that was another leak of kind of banking data. We actually published that story earlier this year, and I think what's interesting about it is, we've got to be empirical here. There's no point in ourselves being kind of conspiratorial. But Trump owes Deutsche Bank, a German bank, about $300 million. And while Deutsche Bank was lending money to Donald Trump, who, by the way, had previously sued the bank and defaulted on a loan, Deutsche Bank in Moscow was running a massive money laundering scheme for VIPs at the top of the Russian state. We don't know who precisely they are, but we do know that Deutsche Bank Moscow laundered about $10 billion and has subsequently been fined by the New York Financial Services Division for doing this. And so we've got money laundering in Moscow, and then simultaneously we've got lending to Mr. Trump in New York. And it's a very, I mean, my chapter is called The Strange Case of the German Bank. And I think, you know, we've tried to get answers from the bank. They've been highly obstructive. And I think there are more questions to be answered there.
There's also an interesting transaction for one of Trump's former homes in Florida. Didn't he buy a mansion in 2004 for $41 million and then sell it 4 years later to a Russian oligarch for $95 million?
This is another very strange story. The Russian oligarch is called Dmitry Ribolovlev.
I wish I could buy a house and get that kind of a return on it 4 years later.
It gets better because Dmitry didn't actually set foot in the house. I was told by his press guy that he put on a pair of bathing trunks and he kind of once walked past on the sea, so he wasn't on the territory from afar. He bought it. But the time he bought it was at the peak of the financial crash when everyone was bust, and he bought it for, Trump made $50 million profit. Now Ribolovlev says it was a good enough investment, nothing to see here, but he subsequently discovered the house had mold, and he demolished it without ever having visited or lived there. I think it's the strangest property transaction in U.S. history.
Steele offered very little to you apart from the guidance to look at the values of his properties. And when you were inquired about alleged sexual misconduct, he said that was interesting, but didn't go into detail.
He didn't. I mean, I think the thing is, you have to understand about Steele is that he's not someone who likes the limelight. I mean, I'm sure you'd probably love to talk to him, but I don't think he'll talk to you or anybody else directly. He didn't want to become the center of attention. He's not a showboater, to use the sort of Trump phrase. He's someone who likes to work in the shadows and who is exceptionally discreet about his clients, about his sources, about his methods. He just really won't kind of talk about them. But at the same time, it was obvious that this wasn't just a kind of financial tale. There was also a kind of level of sexual intrigue to it as well.
Paul Singer, a New York hedge fund billionaire and a Republican donor, was the first to hire Steele's firm. Who was Paul Singer supporting in the primaries?
I'm not sure who Paul was supporting in the primaries. I just know that at that point he was a kind of anti-Trumper. But of course, then he fell out of the game, and at that point the DNC took over. But
the Mark E. Elias.
But one thing again, which I think is underappreciated, is that Steele, when he set off on his inquiries and asked his sources about Trump and Russia, Steele did not know that the client was the DNC. I mean, he found out later, but at that point he had no idea.
Between June and November 2016, Steele sent 16 memos summarizing the investigation into Trump and his ties to Russia. But since Steele wasn't allowed, obviously, we just have to hope that his sources, or we have to rely on his sources?
Well, I mean, I think it's more than that. I mean, I think if you look at what happened, was that basically what Steele wanted was, he realized that this story was enormous, that it had implications for U.S. democracy, for the integrity of the political process, and for international relations. So he essentially turned over his memos to the FBI, and what he wanted them to do was to verify, or indeed, you know, disprove the dossier, because they had the resources, they had the reach, they had the technical capacity. And I think what's also new in this book is his kind of growing frustration with the FBI, because he felt that they were slow, they didn't kind of perceive the gravity of the situation. And meanwhile, there were European intelligence agencies, including the Brits, but also the French, who were sending intelligence to Washington saying, look, you need to be aware that people who are on our grid, who are basically suspected or known Russian intelligence assets, keep meeting Trump people. I mean, don't take my word for it. I mean, read the indictment by Robert Mueller of George Papadopoulos. I mean, he's running around London meeting mysterious Maltese professors who appear to be kind of basically Russian assets, and glamorous women called Olga who present themselves as Putin's niece. I mean, it's a kind of crazy plot, but it's all true. And this was being fed back to the FBI, and I think the FBI were a little slow in getting their heads around it.
Too bad John le Carré didn't invent this. Luke Harding's latest book is Collusion, Secret Meetings, Dirty Money, and How Russia Helped Donald Trump Win. It's published by Vintage. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The next character in the story is Carter Page, who recently told the House Intelligence Committee that he did inform Attorney General Jeff Sessions of his trip to Russia in 2016, although Sessions said just yesterday, I think, that he doesn't remember that.
Well, I mean, I don't want to kind of impugn Jeff Sessions, but he seems to have all sorts of memory issues. And what's very curious, I mean, I sort of say in my book that Sergei Kislyak, who was the Russian ambassador now back in Moscow, but he sort of threads through this story that whenever anyone met him, it's as if that you know, later that they had stumbled into a magical fog because they just simply couldn't remember this. But I mean, Carter Page is another very kind of curious character.
Well, he met with Igor Sessions.
Well, he denies that, but the point is that clearly Steele had a very good source inside Rosneft, which is the oil company run by Igor Sessions, who by the way is effectively Putin's number two, an enormously powerful and influential person, with the might of the kind of Russian state behind him. And Carter Page's problem, apart from the fact that his interviews are disastrous, is that he was being bugged by the FBI because he was spending a lot of time from 2013 onwards with Russian spies.
The backdrop to Russia's interference in our elections was its desire to get sanctions imposed by President Obama lifted. What scared Putin and his cronies the most about the continuation of those sanctions?
Yeah, that's actually a great question. I think the problem of sanctions is that it obviously it does hurt Russia's economy, even though state media says it doesn't, it does. And more to the point, a lot of Putin's kind of cronies, all of whom are billionaires, can no longer travel to the West. They can't come to New York. They can't buy property in London. And they find this personally very inconveniencing. What is the point of having all of that money if you can't go and party? And so it really was the primary objective of Putin to get rid of these sanctions. And
so did Carter Page actually promise that if Donald Trump became president, the sanctions against Russia would be lifted?
Well, that's what the dossier says. I mean, we haven't had confirmation of that, but I think
that seems strongly
the case. But the irony of the situation is that Putin hacking the U.S. election in a way was a tactical triumph. I don't think Putin thought that Hillary would lose. She did lose. Trump came in. And then, of course, the expectation from the Russian side is that sanctions would be immediately dropped. But because this scandal blew up and is still getting bigger and bigger and bigger, it's become politically impossible for Trump to do that, even though he keeps on saying, including yesterday, that he would love to get rid of sanctions.
If you look at Trump's administration, especially in its first stages, there are Russian connections everywhere. Michael Flynn, Paul Manafort, Felix Sater, Michael Cohen, Rex Tillerson, Wilbur Ross, all have links to Moscow. Does that qualify as collusion?
It doesn't necessarily qualify as collusion, but it is, again, it's kind of remarkable. You look at everyone from Trump's orbit and they have a kind of Russian trace. It's almost as if Putin did the picking rather than Trump doing the picking. I mean, Rex Tillerson, I know he has issues with Trump, which is a kind of separate topic. But I was put in a jail cell at the airport in Moscow in 2011 for writing articles critical of Putin. Rex Tillerson, by contrast, 2 years later, is given a sky blue medal by Vladimir Putin, with whom he clinks a champagne glass. He's someone known in Moscow, trusted by Moscow, and he's an oil man. He's not a diplomat, and yet he's Secretary of State. How did that happen? Why did that happen?
A major part of Russia's wealth comes from its oil industry. It sells to Europe. I guess the sanctions have hurt that a bit.
The sanctions have hurt that a lot, and I think that actually explains what Sechin was doing. I mean, they're still very keen to get rid of sanctions, but the Kremlin people have a poor understanding of American institutional politics. They think that the U.S. system is like Russia, where Putin can make a phone call and something happens. They don't understand that there's Congress, there's the media, there are all sorts of things which constrain presidential power.
You interviewed Paul Manafort when he was working in the Ukraine. What were your impressions of him at the time?
Yeah, that's really interesting. So this book is based on, to a large extent, on sources of my own, but also on notes that I accumulated from Moscow and smuggled out when I got kicked out. And I had to smuggle them out. And I went to my cupboard and I was scrabbling through, and I found this interview I did with Paul Manafort in 2008 when he was working for Viktor Yanukovych, who 2 years later becomes president of Ukraine. And Manafort told me that Yanukovych was a reform character, a good guy, a Democrat. And of course, what happened was that he was none of those things. He jailed the opposition leader. He stole billions. He fled to Russia. And basically everything Manafort told me was a lie.
So far, he's only been charged with money laundering.
Well, I suspect that's the beginning. But the thing about Manafort was that he strikes me as being certainly cleverer than most of the people in Trump's entourage. But someone who's profoundly amoral and who, by the way, is trousered, if you believe Mueller, tens of millions of dollars from the former Soviet Union. And of course, he's Trump's campaign manager. Now, why is that?
What about Michael Flynn? Isn't it likely that Mueller will indict both Michael Flynn and his son?
Well, I think the Mueller inquiry seems pretty kind of leak-free, but logically you would expect that Flynn and Flynn Jr. are the next people to be indicted. And again, I talked to Russian defectors from spy agencies about Flynn, and in particular his visit in 2013 to the headquarters of the GRU, that's Russian Military Intelligence. It's the most super secret espionage facility in Russia. Flynn is invited to give a talk on leadership. And my defector contact said, "Do you really think these Russian spies are interested in Flynn's views on leadership?" He said, "When I heard that news, I nearly ate my tie." and in his view, they were checking him out.
You say that reporters should continue to focus on the money and the sex. So in continuing to investigate the story, those are the two factors that are most important?
Well, the money, the sex, and the meetings, I would say. I mean, there are a lot of questions about the money. I think it's quite reasonable for journalists to ask for Donald Trump's tax returns. I mean, I've written a lot about Russian oligarchs and Cyprus, for example, and Donald Trump has got several companies in Cyprus, but you try and get the records, the financial statements, you can't get them. There's a degree of opacity about his holdings in the Trump Organization. Now, maybe he's got nothing to hide. That could be the case. But until we can kind of verify and see for ourselves, we've got to be skeptical.
Are people still getting in touch with you about the story?
We get tips all the time.
I can't wait for the next book.
Some which are so scandalously hair-raising, I just can't share them with you. But I think just lastly, I'd say, I think it's about good method. I think we live in this era of fake news. Your previous guest was talking about that. And unscrupulous states like Russia use this kind of cacophony, all of this noise, the fact that no one knows what's true anymore, to their advantage. And so I think we have to be calm. I think we have to be curious, and we have to be evidential. And I've tried to write a kind of thrilling book that does all of that.
Luke Harding's book is Collusion, Secret Meetings, Dirty Money, and How Russia Helped Donald Trump Win. It's published by Vintage. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.